Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
My name is Edward Frankel. I'm a local Berkeley boy, you know, by way of Russia originally, but I'm a professor at UC Berkeley, a professor of mathematics, and today I have a great pleasure. Can I move this? Oh yes. Today I have a. Can you hear me well? By the way. Okay, great. Today I have a great pleasure to introduce Earl Morris, a legendary filmmaker whom you probably know from such films as Thin Blue Line and Gates of Heaven, The Fog of War, for which he has received an Academy Award. And yes. And more.
Wait a minute, are you applauding the film or the idea of an Oscar?
Both. I would say both.
Is it both?
Both. I was applauding both.
Oh, okay.
So, and more recently, a Netflix series called Wormwood. Wormwood, which I highly recommend, which if you haven't seen it. Wormwood.
Wormwood.
Wormwood. Yes. Now, if this was not enough, Earl is also an accomplished writer, and he has a new book out, which is called The Ashtray, or The Man Who Denied Reality. You will have the opportunity to purchase this book. It's beautiful, beautifully done with beautiful color illustrations.
There are coupons inside, too.
You will be have a chance to get one of those out, just outside of this auditorium at the end of this. But you'll have to stay till the end, you know, to get the book. And so this is the book that we are going to, the subject, you know, the topic of the book is the topic of our conversation today. Now, I have read the book, and which can be, which is attested by the number of bookmarks in my copy that you see here. And there are many things which are highlighted as well. So, you know, I do my homework. And at the beginning of the book, Earl remarks that it is about the relation between meaning, truth, and reality. Words and worlds. Worlds. I'm trying to, you know, practice my English, you know. You can notice my accent, but I hope it's not too much for you. One of the main questions that he poses in this book is whether truth is socially constructed or whether ultimately it concerns reality. And it's a fascinating book, which I really highly recommend, which has lots of interesting stuff and just really fun to read. Well, I might quote, you know, some parts of the book later on. And right off the bat, maybe I should first ask Earl to tell us a little bit about the premise of the book. Why is it called Ashtray?
Called the Ashtray because I was a graduate student at a number of different universities, Princeton being one of them. The University of California, Berkeley. I believe it's located somewhere in
not so far away.
Not so far away. I was a graduate student at a number of universities. I was thrown out of a number of them. I believe this was one of them.
That was before I came here, okay.
Princeton was another. And the occasion of my sudden departure from Princeton involved an ashtray that was thrown at me by my major that's what you call them, my major nemesis. Professor.
Nemesis.
Thomas Kuhn, who became famous, I'm not sure why, but he did become famous because of this book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And for all of those people who have never read it, which is almost everybody, he became famous for a number of phrases that were introduced in that book. Paradigms, paradigm shifts,
yes.
Incommensurability, and so on and so forth.
Scientific revolution, although maybe
scientific revolutions, I think it existed before. Well, let's credit him with that. Why not? Let's give him everything. No, I.
So why did he throw an ashtray at you?
I think it involved anger of some kind.
Perhaps you disagreed with him.
Yeah, we did not like each other, and I found him repulsive. And I found the philosophy incoherent and distressing. No, I think it's very interesting. When I first I published a version of this book in the New York Times as a set of five essays, also entitled The Ashtray, but I hadn't appended the subtitle, The Man Who Denied Reality. That's entirely new. And people started saying, well, you just made that up. That never happened. You know, no professor would throw an ashtray at a student.
And he was a chain smoker, you say, right? So he was kind of like lighting one cigarette from the next from the previous one. And so
he died of lung cancer, and he was one of the more amazing chain smokers I've ever met.
There is a very vivid description in the book of how he was lighting a cigarette and taking the first puff in the middle of a sentence.
Yes. And there would be ashtrays everywhere. I mean, just mountains of butts, filters, ash, matches. And a friend of mine pointed out all those people who said that the ashtray was never thrown at me. Said, well, I guess they really don't know you, because during the time I've known you, I've seen people throw things at you, hot cups of coffee, water, heavy objects, they've hit you, on and on and on. You get the idea.
He missed, though, right? Luckily for all of us.
He missed, yes.
Missed.
And the argument was an interesting argument because it was about how his philosophy was essentially incoherent. It's an argument about how you can't know about the past, but if you can't know about the past, how can you write about not knowing about the past?
Right.
And on and on and on and on and on. That's not the only infirmity, and one of many, but to be sure, an infirmity. And I had said something to him on the occasion of the ashtray throwing. You know, I guess, you know, you can't know about the past holds true for everybody except for some person of such godlike intelligence that they can see beyond everything and know the way things really are. So that was the end of my academic career, more or less. And it's something that I often say that it's one of my mottos, that getting revenge is the best way of living well. Don't you think?
I thought the idiom was about something being cold, served cold.
Yeah, I think just hot, cold, lukewarm. It's best to serve it.
Ultimately. And And served he did, so with this book. But what I found fascinating is that, obviously, a very dramatic encounter or a very dramatic moment with Thomas Kuhn. However, I did not see that book, reading it, I did not see it as a kind of a vendetta, but rather Thomas Kuhn comes across as a foil, as a kind of a, his theory comes across, in my, you know, view when I was reading the book, as kind of a nice starting point for a conversation about what is reality. Does the words, theories, etc. matter? And ultimately, who am I? And what I also found interesting is how I could feel the links, the very deep links between this, what appears on the surface as a philosophical argument. Kuhn's work purported to be a work of philosophy and history of science, right? The philosophy of science. So in the first approximation, the book comes across as a philosophical argument and a very substantial one, because you dig very deeply in, you know, various sources and in carefully crafting your counter argument. But what's even more, what I found even more fascinating is how it links, I felt, how it links in your mind, connects in your mind with a kind of general attitudes, I would say, towards the truth and shared reality that we experience today.
I think that's a nice way to describe it, yes.
And so, and in that sense, I felt the book, of course, is very timely, because obviously we are witnessing today, I would say, an unprecedented assault, I would say, on the sort of consensual reality, on the idea of shared, not necessarily even values, but just facts. Not to get too deep into the subject, but, you know, alternative facts, fake news, etc. In this environment, sometimes it feels like nothing connects us at all. Nothing. There is nothing we share. And in this sense, Thomas Kuhn's argument becomes very much alive. In other words, it's not. It leaves the hallways of the academic world, and bursts into our daily life. The question becomes: is it really true that there is no shared reality? Is it really true that it all that truth is a social construct? At the very beginning of your book, you summarize.
You can make up reality as you go along.
Oh, you can make up, yes. And if you have more power, then you have the opportunity to impose that vision of reality on that vision of truth, etc., on others, right?
Yes.
So, don't worry, we will disagree at some point, but. Here's a passage at the beginning of the book, which I found fascinating. So you say that you find Kuhn's advocacy of the social construction of knowledge to be deeply disturbing, even pernicious. And then you say, I'm still possessed by the image of Kuhn cloistered in the offices at the Institute for Advanced Study, the ultimate, you know, ivory tower, if you will, writing about the absence of progress in science, while bombs were dropping over Southeast Asia. We're talking about 1960s and 70s, the Vietnam War. The reader may think, you say, the two have nothing to do with each other, but for me, they are inseparably connected. How so?
The political reality of what was happening. I'm not sure that this is something that I thought about a lot in those days, although I demonstrated against the war. Princeton is a very odd place to demonstrate. I had been an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison not such an odd place to demonstrate. There were massive demonstrations at the end of the 60s and the early 70s against the war. Princeton, very different. There was an Institute for Defense Analysis, which was adjacent to the campus, and I was part of demonstrations against that. They were involved in doing work for the Pentagon and for the war in Vietnam. And it was really interesting to demonstrate in Wisconsin versus Princeton. In Wisconsin, the police were not afraid of the students. They looked forward to beating the shit out of them. In Princeton, they were more apprehensive. And the only student who got beaten the first day of the demonstrations was black. So I figure they saw an opportunity and availed themselves of it. I think the important thing to remember when you cut through all of this nonsense is that there is a world out there in which things happen. You know, I often think that this is a really, truly benighted species, the species that I'm a member of. But one of the things that may make it kind of, if not okay, something that gives it dignity, is that we pursue truth, or we try. Maybe we don't find it, but we pursue it. We see it as a goal, as a quest. And I think that's true in mathematics. It's true in science. It's true in a lot of things.
And as you're saying, it's not something that, you know, you get on the handed to you on a platter. It's not something that easy to come by. And that's where I felt, you know, you actually invoke in a couple of places, in a few places actually, you invoke your films such as The Thin Blue Line. So for those who have seen it, and those who haven't, immediately have to go and see it after this event, in my opinion. The truth takes the form of a very concrete question of a very concrete human being. It's about a man who is wrongfully accused of murder and sentenced to death. Then eventually, on technicality, it's changed to life sentence. Randall Adams.
Yes.
And he actually was not, as it turns out, eventually, he was not even present at the crime scene. So, but he's essentially framed by the police, by the prosecution.
And by the chief prosecution witness.
And the witnesses, etc. And so, your film, maybe you can tell us a little bit about this. So I was actually... there are several parts of this which I find fascinating, that even after your film came out, which in my view, you know, my estimation kind of very convincingly proves that Randall Adams is not guilty. For one thing, the other man essentially admits his guilt in a conversation with you, right?
Yes.
But even after this movie came out, it took, what, 2 years or so?
It took a while to make the movie. It took a while to get him out of prison.
But even after the movie came out, because the lies were so corrosive, and they spread out, and so many people were involved one way or another, and there were so many people who had a vested interest in the truth not coming out, right? That actually took... So one judge was sitting on a decision for, what, like a year and a half or something, and then he came up, he finally wrote the decision, and then people found out that the judge was actually involved, and he absolutely had to recuse himself. So he added another, you know, 18 months or whatever of torture to this man, you know, this innocent man. And it went on and on and on. And sort of like, what I find fascinating in this story is not just... that the man was wronged, but how then there was this cabal almost of people who were not interested in the truth coming out, right? And so that it had to be really broken.
People were not only not interested in the truth, they often do their level-headed best to prevent the truth from ever being known. And it doesn't even have to be conscious. It can be something really completely unconscious.
Right.
It doesn't have to be based on a desire to fuck somebody over. It could be based on the fact that they truly believe that the guy is guilty, even though they've never really examined the evidence, they've never really thought about the case carefully.
Because it fits somehow in the narrative that they are subscribed to, into their it fits their belief system. Right?
People love narratives.
Yes, and beliefs, right?
And beliefs.
So
I always think about being a private detective. I was a private detective for a number of years, and maybe I've always been a private detective. I was a private detective then, and when I realized I was going back to filmmaking and I started The Thin Blue Line without really even knowing what I was doing, I didn't even know about the case at the very beginning. I said to myself, well, thank God I don't have to be a private detective anymore. But in fact, I was a private detective even more so for 3-4 years working on this particular case. And maybe being a detective simplifies the world in a certain way. You know, we can argue about the nature of proof in mathematics and what constitutes a proof. And I mean, Arthur Jaffe himself got in a lot of trouble.
Oh, yes. There was a big discussion in mathematics at some point about this.
Yeah. About the nature of mathematical proof.
Yes.
Which many people would like to think is unambiguous. But in detective work, you know, you make an assumption. This is a lonely road in West Dallas. Cops are at a Burger King. Robert Wood and his partner, Teresa Turco. Teresa Turco has ordered a chocolate milkshake. And it's a cold, very cold night.
It's just midnight, right? 12:30.
Yeah, they see a car coming down this lonely road without the headlights on. You know, so if you're a cop, what do? You stop the car and you tell them, hey, turn your headlights on. And the policewoman stayed in the car slurping her milkshake. And the police officer, her partner, got out, walked up to the driver's side of this vehicle. And the driver of that stopped car pumped 5 bullets into him and killed him. Car speeds off into the night. But what do I know about this case? Maybe I don't know the identity of the driver. Maybe I don't know whether there were other occupants. But I know something, I would say, with a certain level of certainty. Someone pulled that gun out, pulled the trigger, and shot that cop. Now, it's not up for grabs whether he's alive or dead. He's dead. And someone killed him. And what's my job? My job is to find out who did it. Who killed him? Who killed the cop? And for all intents and purposes, it was simple. Simple in this sense. Either there was one person in the car or two. And I had to figure out which was it, one or the other. So I'm a firm believer. I always characterize it, I think correctly so, as a version of postmodernism, where you say reality is up for grabs, how many people were actually in the inaugural crowd at Trump's inauguration, you know.
Yeah, it starts with little things, right? And it's all fun and games until...
It isn't fun and games.
Until his people start dying, basically.
And I think of Randall Adams, you know, bummer dude. You came within 48 hours of being strapped into old Sparky. I didn't want to sit in old Sparky, but I certainly got to visit old Sparky in Texas. Came within, you know, a very short period of time of being strapped in that electric chair and electrocuted. It's one of my very favorite lines, by the way. This is true. When you were taken into the death chamber, say someone like yourself.
That is sweet.
You're taken into the death chamber, and the warden says to you, please have a seat. And at least he said, please. Aren't you supposed to, when someone says please, you're supposed to...
Well, yeah, it's supposed to, it's being nice to you, so...
Yeah.
Right. No, so to go back to the book, so it would be vast simplification, I suppose, but one could say that Mr. Kuhn would argue that in this case, he may even accept the fact that the policeman was killed. But then he might argue that from one paradigm is that this man killed the policeman, right? Killed the cop. And another paradigm is that someone else killed the cop. But we don't really know. That's roughly the gist of it.
Yeah, and since the paradigms are incommensurable, you can't really compare one with the other.
At some point, they get shifted
around magically.
By magic, right? So, and you are not okay with that somehow.
No, it sucks.
Why? So what is why? And I'm not being facetious. There's something you said just now. You said my job was to find who was the killer. Why? Why do you care?
Why do I care? Because I know that something happened, and I want to know what it was that did happen. I want to be somehow connected to the world. I want to be outside of the stupid prison of my head and to reach out beyond subjectivity to something that's real. And I believe it can be done. I mean, people, God knows, argue about this thing unendingly. You know, how could we ever hope to know about the world around us? After all, we are these organisms, filthy organisms, trapped inside of our heads, imagining what might be out there in the world. Probably
we could have done much worse, by the way. I mean, it's not so bad what we're imagining right now.
Yeah, what are we imagining right now? We're inside ourselves looking out, not in the world looking in. And it's very much a book about my belief that we can reach out.
But most of the time, I would say, if I may interrupt, most of the time we are caught up in this inner narrative and so on. But I feel as though it's exactly in this moment of courage and sincerity, because first of all, you went there, you went to Texas, not because of this case. You went to make another film about a man, a psychologist who played a big role in sort of condemning people to death, because he would argue time after time, without any evidence, or oftentimes without sufficient evidence, he would argue that the people accused of, you know, various crimes were sociopaths, and they would have to be, because the law in Texas at the time, right,
yeah,
was that the jury had to be convinced that the person, in order to render a death sentence, a jury had to be convinced.
Imagine this. Imagine you're on trial for your life, and you're in Texas. You also know that in Texas, people do get executed fairly routinely. There are convictions, there are death sentences, there are executions. In the Texas law, there's a provision that says that to be put to death, someone has to make a prediction not about what you did, but what you're going to do. They have to make a prediction about your future behavior. Believe it or not, very, very, very recently, I wrote a whole set of essays for the New York Times on this. There was a man who had been sentenced to death because of a prediction of his future behavior based on the fact he was black. You know, black people, according to the psychologist who testified his trial, have a much greater propensity to commit crimes, violent crimes. They're more often recidivists. Now, if you're me, probably not even if you're me, you find this utterly appalling. I mean, what kind of a country do we live in? Do we sentence people to death because they're black? All or in part?
And now, of course, we have also various algorithms which are being employed by various government agencies of that nature, which there have been a number of articles in the press about how biased those arguments are towards minorities, and so it's becoming a more serious issue. In the case of that psychologist in Texas who was a sociopath, in my opinion, he was a sociopath essentially, right? So there was this one guy who was basically condemning.
Well, I used to say that you can't really predict human behavior, except in one instance. He became known as Dr. Death, Dr. James Grigson. And what Dr. Grigson will say at the penalty phase of your capital murder trial, you know, he'll say you're going to continue to kill and kill and kill again until you're killed by the state. That you can predict with almost 100% accuracy. The rest of it's really up for grabs.
Right. So you originally went to Texas to make a film about him.
Yeah.
Right? And that's how you found out about, because you were basically, you wanted to see some of the...
I felt bad for him. He was losing his private patients. he told me, he said, you know, it's really hard. You become known as Dr. Death, and your private patients just don't want to...
Somehow don't appreciate it.
They don't want to see you anymore. They have misgivings for whatever crazy reason. They just don't want to do it.
This nickname somehow just
doesn't work. Yeah, the nickname.
It doesn't work.
You get, you know, tarred with the damn name, the damn nickname.
And so then you wanted to interview some of the people on death row who were basically condemned to death because of this guy, right? And that's how you came across Randall Adams.
Yeah, I had prisoner auditions. I went to death row and various prisons where people had been on death row but had been commuted off and had prisoner auditions. And this was a bizarre interview. I mean, he the only one who told me I didn't do it? No, there are people who tell you I didn't do it. You probably will tell me the same thing if I ask you.
Oh, yeah, probably. Yeah.
No, I didn't do
it. And he told you, Dr. Death told you, when you go talk to these inmates, they will all claim they didn't do it. Don't pay attention to that.
Yeah.
Right? I'm a psychologist. I know. That's how they talk. Yeah, right? Yeah. So, I mean, and then you come across this guy, right? And somehow there was something that kind of stopped you in your tracks. And
you know what it was? It's sort of pathetic. What it was is I thought, this guy's really, really kind of weird. He's goofy. He'll be a great movie character. I didn't think...
That's what saved his life, you know, being goofy.
I didn't think one way or the other about his guilt or innocence. That came later. I became fascinated by him because the story was so strange. He kept talking about the kid, you know, they set the kid up. And I started to wonder, like, who's the kid? We should meet the guy. And
so the story was that it was actually another person who shot the cop.
You want a fast story?
Yeah.
I'll try to make it fast.
Okay, you can do it better than me, I suppose.
Well, you don't know the story, so I think...
Well, but it's possible to know the truth, Earl, you know?
Yeah.
It can be shared, you know? So anyway.
Yeah. But the kid started to fascinate me. So there's a line that I like from film noir, from Robert Mitchum's Out of the Past. And it's in Wormwood. If you've seen Wormwood, I quote that scene in Wormwood, the scene with Robert Mitchum and the cab driver. And Mitchum says, "I could see the frame, but I couldn't see the picture." What a great line. And I could see the frame, but I couldn't see the picture. I knew that there was something about the kid. And to make a long story short, I arranged to meet him. We met at a lonely bar in the swamp outside of Vidor, Texas, which is, you know, not the nicest place that you can imagine. Home of the Ku Klux Klan. So we're meeting in this lonely bar, and David had just gotten out of prison for a whole other series of crimes that he had committed. And I started to get the creeps. And I did something that is actually probably, I've done so many stupid things, I hesitate to call it the stupidest thing I haven't done. But it's among the stupider things that I have done. I looked at him. I don't know if you're familiar with this situation. You're talking to someone and you're afraid they're thinking something that you don't want them to be thinking. So you tell them you're not thinking that, what you're afraid they might be thinking, and in the process tell them that in fact, indeed, you are thinking exactly that. And so I said, you know, I'm really glad I got a chance to meet you because, you know, I wondered whether you were the killer. And of course, I can tell talking to you now that that's really out of the question. And he gave me this what the fuck look.
Mr. Private Investigator.
What the fuck are you talking about? Yeah. And that night, I drove this really lonely route back from Vidor to Huntsville, Texas, where I was staying. And just before I left the bar, he said, you know, I want you to be really careful driving home. So when someone says that to you once, you think, well, maybe I want to be careful driving home. When they say it to you twice, and then three times, you think, oh, fuck. He's going to kill me. So that was the beginning of my two-year odyssey investigating the Thin Blue Line. And I'm very proud of it. Why wouldn't I be?
And that's the point that I was making earlier, which is that with all this, you know, us being, a lot of the time being lost and, you know, confined in this narrow window of reality that we picture for ourselves, etc. I am this little being who is against the whole world. I have these beliefs, I have those beliefs. I don't like these people, I like these people, etc. For all of that, there are...
You know, it's much simpler if you don't like anybody. Just a small, you can ask for my advice.
For instance. Like, and yet, what makes... If it was just like that all the time, you see, it would be sort of boring, I think. And what gives life the spark, I think, what gives us... It's exactly this moment when we transcend. And so the story which Earl shared with us now, and you know, obviously you can see the film, etc. To me, it is one of those stories which in some sense make life, well, it may sound a little too, you know, pompous, but I really mean it, make life worth living in the sense that these are exactly the moments when something else comes through. When it's not just, if he was just this little creature, this little being confined in his body, in his skull, why would he ever care about a fellow human being, you know? And he did. And it took a lot of courage and a lot of work. And the man was released. And justice was served. So it is that which, in a sense... That's the argument, that's the best counter-argument against Thomas Kuhn for me, you know. So that's, So Mr. Kuhn, wherever you are, try to top that. You know, like, try to top that, because sitting in an ivory tower and smoking cigarettes and throwing your ashtrays, you know, is childish and immature, and it's not life. It's a caricature of life, you know. So that's sort of my take on this.
Oh. Yeah.
Moving on. because ultimately, you see, I'm a mathematician, and so obviously for me, by the way, when I was a student in Russia, undergraduate, I heard about Thomas Kuhn's book, Structure of Scientific Revolutions. I was very interested in philosophy and history of science and so on. So I wanted to get a hold of it, and there was a Russian translation indeed. I actually just pulled, I found it on my bookshelf this morning, and I pulled it off. Wow. And I thought of bringing it here, but then I was like, nah. And I got this book. And
we all believe that you have a Russian version of Structure of Scientific Revolutions.
Yes. And I started reading it, and I was underwhelmed, I have to say. I feel like there are some interesting ideas, but what kind of killed it for me, and even if I didn't quite understand it at the time, I understand it more clearly now, is this the shadow, the big shadow of this ego, you know, megalomaniac who has finally got it, who has finally built a unified theory of everything, you know, and we are so lucky that he's sharing it with us, you see what I mean? And so, for me as a mathematician, it was natural to strive for something like this, because obviously, that's what we always hear from scientists, especially our dear friends physicists always talk about grand unified theory. It's like, oh my God, we're going to write these equations down. We can even put it on a t-shirt, and like we have all the equations and of the world, and we know everything. And so it's much later, and I like this idea. It's much later that I realized how silly, you know, this was. And even, you know, so yesterday we had a conversation about another film that you made, A Brief History of Time.
Yes.
So Stephen Hawking, of course, being a great, you know, physicist, ostensibly is very much subscribing to this idea and saying, for instance, in the film, saying, and in his book, we may be able, if we write this, I'm not going to try to imitate, but if we write these equations, we will finally be able to understand the mind of God. Yeah. And I'm just like, oh my God, you know. So, however, at the same time, it's almost like there is this smile behind it. He's sort of saying it slightly tongue in cheek, and he actually then also adds, okay, so we write the equations, but who breathes the fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? Therefore, showing this sort of wisdom that, okay, so maybe we will write the equations, but that's not the whole story, right?
Yeah. Hawking is endlessly perverse, ironic, funny. I mean, he's endlessly asked to opine. I don't know how many lectures that I went to that he gave. People asking him about, does God exist? Does he, you know, he doesn't? Oh, he does? endless questions about the universe. And, oh, I can tell this story. I'm never going to work again anyway. I had been hired to make Brief History of Time. You'll like this story, I think. I've been hired to do A Brief History of Time by Steven Spielberg. And Steven Spielberg saw the rough cut of Brief History of Time, and I was fired. I don't want you just to think that I'm thrown out of universities. I'm also fired from film projects as well. Yeah, and so it was only due to Kathy Kennedy, who ran Amblin Entertainment, that the project was saved. And I was witness. It was actually one of the stranger experiences of my life, and I've had a fair number of strange experiences. I was witness to what I call the Steven meets Steven meeting at Amblin Entertainment. V meets PH, and Steven with the V, Steven with the PH. You can sort out which is which.
Ah, okay.
And
it took me a few seconds.
Steven Spielberg had perched an E.T. on the edge of Hawking's wheelchair and then had himself photographed repeatedly with Hawking. Do I really want to tell this story? All of a sudden it runs through my mind, I actually may want something from these people someday.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do. So he started asking Hawking these questions. Do you think there will be an end to cancer before, this was in 1991, before the end of the century? And Hawking said, I don't know. Do you think there'll be a cure for AIDS before the end of the century? And Hawking said, because he had it already programmed, I don't know. And
just press the button. Yeah.
You know, do you think there'll be an end to cancer before there's an end, you know, to AIDS, a cure? And Hawking said, I don't know. And my wife leaned over and said to me, said, I think he's really confused about what kind of a doctor he is. So he loves to play Oracle. Do I think ultimately that he sees himself that way? I don't. He's so unbelievably funny.
He's funny, and it feels as though he doesn't take himself very seriously.
No, he doesn't. He had all these pictures of Marilyn Monroe in his office. They're all over the office. And so we had reconstructed the office a facsimile of Stephen Hawking's office at DAMP, the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics. We had reconstructed
it. In Cambridge, England.
Well, it's the real office is in Cambridge. We reconstructed it at Elstree Studios in London, and along with the Marilyn photographs on the wall. And we didn't do a really good job of gluing them to the wall. So during one take, the Marilyn photograph started to fall off. And Hawking said, a fallen woman. And
he was very observant. So I had one episode with him where I was absolutely struck that he was the only one who could see what's going on and everybody else was completely.
Yeah. And so I later said to him, I said, you know, I finally figured it out, why you love Marilyn Monroe so much. He gives me this look, and I say, it's because, like Marilyn, you're appreciated for your body and not for your mind. And he gave me this incredibly weird look. And there was this pause, and then he said, yes. I love the guy. What was there not to love about him? Fantastic.
Right, so
my office is near Kendall Square. We took Hawking to the legal seafood at Kendall Square because Hawking loves lobster. And to see Stephen Hawking being fed a 3-pound lobster and consuming it with enthusiasm, it's one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. Quite unforgettable.
See, so, by the way, in the book, it may appear from what
I said earlier, it's a very serious book, you know, it's a very scholarly book, which it is at some level, because, you know, it makes a very precise argument. But it's very accessible at the same time. But and also, it has a lot of fun in it. I, you know, for instance, there are interviews with all kinds of interesting people, like philosopher Hilary Putnam and Noam Chomsky, Steven Weinberg, the great physicist, Nobel Prize winner. And there is another part which I love, which is at the end of the book, where, you know, sometimes you have like glossary or something. He has a cast of characters.
Yeah.
And I'll just read if you don't mind. I'll just read a couple of my favorite. So there's here's what he says about Philip Dick. You know, the science fiction. Well, much more than that, but science fiction writer.
A former Berkeley resident.
Also Berkeley resident. Oh yes, I should also say that Berkeley figures prominently in this whole story. First of all.
It's a really fucked up place. Don't ever go there.
Don't we know? Don't we know, right? I mean, that's why we live here. But, you know, I mean, obviously. So, first of all, Thomas Kuhn wrote the book here, right? He was working.
Yes. Yes.
So that's one thing which counts for him. It's like his last, you know, thing that we could, okay, fine. And also, what else? You were here. Right, and so, and well, and we are here now. So anyway, so there's a lot of things connected to Berkeley, yeah. But also Philip Dick was here in Berkeley as well.
He
right?
was. It's amazing. Yes.
And so what you say, here's what Earl says about Philip Dick in this cast of characters at the end of the book. He says, Philip K. Dick, Latter Day Cassandra, never saw a paranoid idea he didn't like. And he goes, still my favorite. Dick Nightmare is in Ubik, his novel. You think you are alive, but you are really dead. Hear, hear. Then there is another one which I like. Robert McNamara, my favorite war criminal. I came to love this man. How could you not love a man so tortured by guilt and so aware of the reasons for that guilt?
Yeah.
So you also bring up at the end of the book, you bring up your film mentioned earlier, The Fog of War.
Yes.
Which
can I read one of those?
Sure.
That I rather like. Yeah. There are a number of them, but at the very end, I have this abiding hatred of Wittgenstein. Just
oh,
so
yes,
you
this
know.
One. I was debating whether to read it or not, but I guess now the debate is settled.
Yeah, and someone castigated me. I saw this on Twitter, so I could also read this and reply. Ludwig Wittgenstein, a notorious book, The Jew of Linz. Do you know about this book?
No, now I know after I read it, yes.
Yeah. By Kimberly Cornish, reprints a picture of students at the Real Schule in Linz, Austria, at the beginning of the 20th century. The picture is said to include two famous, or if you prefer, infamous figures, Ludwig Wittgenstein and Adolf Hitler. Is it really them? Arguments have gone back and forth, and I don't know. But they were both enrolled at the Real Schule around the same time, circa 1903. I often ask the seemingly rhetorical question, when showing people the photograph, which of these two did the greater damage in the 20th century? Okay, it was Hitler. But think about it.
Think about it. I take it you didn't like Wittgenstein. There's a lot of he appears in many conversations and discussions in the book. Here is maybe one I would like to read one more about Borges. That there is a beautiful anecdote about Borges, the great writer, whom I guess you like very much.
I adore.
He says, a genius among geniuses. So when he likes somebody, okay, so then it's like a genius among geniuses. Not so many, but yeah. And he says, so Earl says, after all, he imagined a language and a world without nouns.
By the way, do you know his short story, Everything and Nothing?
Yes.
It's nice, no?
Oh, yeah.
Very, very relevant to this conversation,
isn't
it?
Indeed it is.
So then, here's the anecdote. Late in life, Borges, completely blind, was standing in front of a very busy and broad intersection in Buenos Aires. He was hoping that someone would come and guide him across. Finally, someone took his hand, and together they made their way to the other side. The man who took his hand said, "Thank you. I was really worried about crossing this road. You see, I'm blind." So, we hold each other's hands, and we help each other across the street, right, across the road. We have 15 minutes left, and I think it's a good moment to ask the audience
sure.
if there are any questions. Do we have microphones?
Have a question? Come over here, and if you cannot make it, I'll bring the microphone to you.
Hi. In Wormwood, you use a lot of dramatizations, and I wanted to ask what the role of fiction and dramatization is in telling truth, and whether you had rules around how to construct those dramatizations.
Well, probably the important thing to remember is it's all fiction. This distinction between documentary and drama is an important distinction, I guess, but it's certainly not about truth. It doesn't really involve truth, ultimately. You can be making a dramatic film, or a film involving the script and actors, and if they're saying things about the real world, those things have truth value, regardless of whether they're part of a drama or not. And I could say the same thing the other way around about documentary. One thing that I do know about truth, when I made The Thin Blue Line years and years ago, I put these reenactments in the movie. Actually, I don't even like the term reenactment, because I was reenacting untruth rather than truth. I was trying to bring you into the crime scene to think about possible worlds, actually. What could have happened? Could it have been this? Could it have been that? Does this make sense? Does that make sense? It was a way of bringing you into the world by showing you various possibilities. Maybe Saul Kripke would approve. I don't know. However, when this was shown to the documentary committee of the Academy, I was told that in those days they had limited time to see a lot of these movies, and they had flashlights, and if they wanted it turned off, they'd wave the flashlights. And so immediately the first reenactment, Philip Glass music was bad enough. The Philip Glass music starts grinding on, you know, like the... And the ostinato, the deathly ostinato, started. And was it a French horn? No, it was an oboe. And so they saw the reenactment, and they started waving. I like to think they were hysterically waving the flashlights. And they turned the movie off, and that was it. That was it. You know, for years people would say, well, that's not really a documentary. And yes, it annoyed me. Because what's a documentary? I mean, you obey a certain set of rules. You handhold your camera. You use available light. You think that's what truth is? If my camera is handheld, that's going to be truth? I would submit the only person who could really, really believe that has to be a moron.
Like Thomas Kuhn.
A moron. Or a friend of mine, when I was in high school, he used to tell me that average people were ons, and then there was, you know, smarter and smarter people, less ons and least ons, and then in the other direction, there were more ons and, of course, most ons.
That's a good way.
All right. It's the most on, so you have to be most frightened of.
Yeah. My question is and it's sort of hard to phrase. So you went to Texas, and you had this concept that you were going to interview this individual, and you pull at a thread. Say you have a quilt that was in front of you.
I was pulling on a thread, yes.
You pulled on a thread, and then you found one. Gee, this is really interesting, and this is an untruth or a truth. And so then you wove a new quilt or new tapestry here.
Yes.
Now, my favorite film of yours is when you went to Florida to talk about the people that were shooting themselves, and you ended up making Vernon, Florida, which resides in my heart forever.
Thank you. You
did the same thing, and I don't know whether did you become enamored with some of the people, like the guy at glasses with the little tape, or the turkey hunter, or how do you decide you want to finish this though?
I love those guys. I mean, I love the people that I film. I mean, I've interviewed all kinds of people. War criminals, psycho killers, assholes of every variety.
War criminals.
And nice people. I must get a kick out of doing this. The only person I did not take a shine to, and I've, you know, interviewed Ed Kemper and Charles Manson and Ed Gein. The only person I didn't really approve of, and I really wanted to like the guy. I thought to myself, what is wrong with you, Errol? I just couldn't bring myself to like Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, I suppose you're not alone in this room in that respect.
But in Vernon, Florida, I mean, some of the lines are among... I was just quoting Vernon, Florida the other day. There was this guy named Claude Register who's talking about writing dog shit with one hand and cat shit with the other. One of my beloved characters. He told me, he said, you know, you can remember my name because you have to register for everything. And in the middle of this... I don't know, monologue, he said, God created all things. And he said they were good and very good.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
And I've always liked that. I can try to
it
think.
It sounded like he's quoting scripture, right? But actually, I don't think.
I've never been able to find it.
He also said, it was the guy who said, just happened, right?
Just happened.
That's God.
That's right. I thought that actually was one of the, if God is just caprice, if God is that just happened, what kind of God is that? You know, I think I'll start praying to, I don't know, Lehman Brothers.
But of course, you know, in the beginning, the movie, the film.
Except they don't exist anymore.
The film starts with this guy who is photographing the stars with a opera binoculars, right? And he says, "Reality? You're calling this reality? Ha ha ha!"
Right? Said, "I never thought of that."
I never thought of that.
Yeah,
never. Very relevant to this book too, right?
So. Oh yes, very much so. They're all of a piece.
You know, I feel like the Almodovar has, you know, in Talk to Her. He has this scene at the end of Talk to Her where all the characters from his previous movies, they all gather and they have this, they share this moment, and it's beautiful music. So I just kind of feel one day maybe, you know, there will be a reunion of all of us.
I can gather them all together.
Yes.
There would be quite a collection, I might add.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Hi, over here.
Oh.
When I saw Thin Blue Line a million years ago, it was a knockout, not just because of the techniques and all, because it had an effect. And this brings us back to this idea of what science does, okay? The specificity is the idea of intervening and or predicting. So in this case of the Thin Blue Line, you intervened. There was this idea that the world was changed in this very specific sense, and that I teach philosophy of science as well. But when I teach it, that's one of the branches is a kind of very pragmatic sense of what science does, And we don't have to talk about Kuhn and Feyerabend and Wittgenstein, but the idea that is eventually coming to be the case and is this idea of specificity in what you're describing, that when you're telling a story about the world, it's composed of facts, quote unquote, and a narrative, and you put it together and you have a better or less capable ability of intervening and or predicting. And I thought A Thin Blue Line was a perfect kind of portrayal of that in action. There was this idea of research, a narrative, whether you have reenactments or quote-unquote facts of the documentary, and then you come up with a very strong narrative that's filled with a specificity. So I just love this, the way you deal with all these kinds of issues.
One thing that runs through the ashtray, in addition to bile, someone asked me, the book would have been a lot stronger if you told the other side. I said, oh, really, thank you for suggesting that, because I'm really working very, very hard on this biography of Hitler.
But actually, in my view, you are giving sort of equal time in the set. You are presenting the arguments, and I don't feel that you are, that you are being unfair. So,
oh, that's too bad. But thank you. I don't know. With science, I would say there's two pictures that you could imagine. A picture of discovery. You're circumnavigating the globe in a leaky boat in the 16th century. And you discover an island, and you name it. To me, science is like that. You're not inventing the objects of science. You're not inventing the objects of mathematics.
Yes, I was going to say, even in mathematics, our view, most practitioners, is that we are discovering something in sort of enchanted gardens of this mathematical platonic reality or something.
Yeah, you're in the leaky vessel, circumnavigating the globe and finding new land.
Okay.
And I find that image, there's something that I quote from Matthew Meselson, who I know, who's a professor of biochemistry at, I call it the junior college down the street from where I live, Harvard. And
little known school in Massachusetts.
Yes. And although I did see a t-shirt recently that I liked, it said Harvard, the Harvard of the East. But Meselson never got a Nobel for reasons I can't. He's the guy who discovered how, it's the first major result after Watson-Crick. He discovered how DNA replicates. And Meselson-Stahl, which is the experiment we established this, is one of the great experiments in biology. And he describes this discovery of that it's something out there in the world waiting for you to find it out. And I think that's an important thing to remember. I told my, friend Saul Kripke, who is the really inspiration for this entire book. I can't even imagine
he's it. He's a good guy. He's a good guy in the book.
He is a good guy in the book, and he's a good guy in general. And he is in the category of being really smart. And I wanted to write an essay on who's afraid of naive realism. Because there is a world out there. Why would you want to deny it? What we should all do is try to find out more about it.
Sounds good to me. We have time for one more question.
Okay, great. Hi. So, like you, I'm not a big fan of Kuhn's ideas. And in addition to not being a big fan, I also don't really see what's appealing about them. And I'm curious if you have any insight into what Kuhn found appealing about them. Like, why was he drawn to these things? What was it about him that made him like this somewhat perverse vision of the world?
Can I provide a diagnosis? He was an asshole.
Given that, I feel as though, actually for me, one of the most riveting sort of passages in the book was that there was a quotation from a book by another, by a philosopher from Berkeley, I forgot his name, who was a friend of Kuhn's with whom he discussed.
Stanley Cavell?
Yes.
Yes.
In which they talk about the kind of the, he remembered how Kuhn was coming up with these ideas. And you kind of allude that his worldview was, may have been shaped in part because of Holocaust and because of history, and that he was obsessed with these ideas. Would you care to comment on this?
Yeah, I'm obsessed with the Holocaust. I mean, why wouldn't I be? I'm a Jew. I was born not that many years after the liberation of Auschwitz. I would say it's been an obsession with the Nazis my entire life. And this is a little bit of an essay on history. I made a film in Auschwitz called Mr. Death, The Rise and Fall of Fred Lucher, a Holocaust denier and electric chair repairman. It's a, my God, it's a good combination of and he had a work ethic. No, I read about it on the front page of the New York Times. You know, I find there was an article, Can Capital Punishment Be Humane? There was Fred with his various electrocution devices that he had developed. They're all systems. The electric chair system, the lethal injection system, blah, blah, blah. And I read the article. Would I have made a movie just because of the execution stuff? Probably not. I get to the end of the article and it says, and oh, by the way, he's a Holocaust denier. And I think, okay, I'm there. Sign me up. And I had occasion to go to Auschwitz and to Birkenau with this Holocaust historian, and we had access to the entire Birkenau archive. And I'll try to do this very, very, very quickly. Birkenau was the killing factory. Millions of people died there. It was designed as a killing factory and operated as a killing factory, make no mistake. And the Nazis destroyed the Auschwitz archives as they pulled out in January of 1945. But they forgot the building archive for Birkenau. And that was left intact. A huge archive about how this extermination camp was constructed, how it was put together. And I remember thinking at the time, the one thing we know about architecture is it's premeditated. And I'm going through the papers at the Auschwitz archive, and there's a carbon copy of a document. I had become familiar with the document because it had been republished in black and white, and not extremely well. But here was the document in my hands. I'm holding this thing. And I had noticed in the black and white facsimile, a line had been underlined really heavily. Almost it looked as though the pen or the pencil was breaking through the page, the onion skin paper that was used for carbon copies. And in the original, I could see that it was in red, and there was red annotations on the top of the page that were not seen in the facsimile, and it was written by an SS officer. The line underlined was Vergasungskeller, gassing basement, and at the top it said that that word was never to be used again in any official correspondence. And I remember looking at this thing and thinking, and I've never, ever, ever had reason to believe that the Holocaust didn't happen. I'm a Jew, a mother whose first language in America was Yiddish. But I remember at that moment almost starting to cry, because I thought, my God, it's all true. It's all fucking true. This really indeed did happen. And that connection, that immediate connection with historical reality, something that you could actually feel in your hands, you could see with your eyes, was extraordinarily powerful. And I've had that experience, you know, I've been lucky a number of times in my life. And it's unforgettable. Never, ever, ever forget that history is real. Napoleon, and now I'm babbling, and forgive me, I'll stop. I promise I'll stop. And Napoleon, exiled on this island in the South Atlantic, St. Helena, 6 years before he died, started dictating to his various factota who joined him on the island in exile. And one of the things he wrote is, history is an agreed upon fiction. And I would say, wrong. History is the history of a world that is really out there. History really happened. And just like those undiscovered continents, whether they be molecules or formula, they're very much real and deserving of our attention.
Well, on this note.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.